Yeah, I've had a great career that getting to do lots of different things. I feel like all my family practice experience has led me to this position that I have now, which I love. So, it's great.
Well,
I love.
I can't wait to hear what you have to say. And I guess Dina hasn't come back yet.
Well,
well,
it's good. I hope I'm. I sort of picked what I thought people might be interested in, and so and it's going to last 20 minutes or so, and then I just thought we can have discussion because there's more to be said about this, and you could talk. You know, you could present a whole day conference on it.
Sure.
But so I just thought we would do an overview about various things, and then leave time for questions or comments or things like that.
Perfect.
Excellent.
Get started.
What?
Oh, okay. Are we starting now? Okay.
Yeah, is that Dina start? Well, go ahead. Okay. Hello, everybody. My name is Scott Moskowitz. I'm one of the adult regional coordinators for the Peter Sclerosis Alliance. Tonight we have a very special guest, Karen Agricola. She's one of the advanced practice registered nurses or nurse practitioners for Cincinnati Children's to the Sclerosis Clinic, and she's been there since 2007. She had to coordinate initial and follow-up visits for the patients at their TS clinic, and she works closely with the TSC doctors and specialists in all ranges of modalities, pulmonary, nephrology, psychiatric, radiology, cardiology, genetics, social work, and plastic surgery, to just end it right there. So she's used to modifying treatment plans to address the patient's needs, and she sees patients for follow-up visits in the clinic and also does clinical research. The teams meet weekly to plan all the patients' upcoming visits, discuss new developments in research and management and medical management, and how they can improve treatment strategies for their patients. I think that's a beautiful overview besides going to a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. Nurse practitioner, she's been in business since 1990. So, Karen, I'm going to let you take it away. Just so people will give you what's the program. Karen's going to talk for about 20, 25 minutes or 30 minutes, and then the rest will be Q&A up until 9 o'clock. So looking forward to hearing from you, Karen. You're on.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. And thank you for inviting me to participate in this. It's a really important topic to discuss, and I'm feel honored to have been invited. So, and thank you all who have joined the call. So, I'd also like to thank my colleague, Dr. Nishant Gupta, for helping me to prepare this presentation. Dr. Gupta is the medical director of the International LAM Clinic Network and one of the LAM specialists who sees our patients with LAM at Cincinnati Children's TS Clinic. So, what I'm going to do is present an overview. We're going to talk about what TSC LAM is and how it is screened, how you screen for it, and what happens after you're diagnosed with LAM. And we're going to talk about different treatments. We're going to talk about things that people with LAM need to know about. And we are going to talk about some research opportunities if you're interested in that. So let's get started. So we're going to talk about TSC LAM. LAM can actually occur sporadically in primarily women who do not have TS, and it's a little bit different. So considering the audience, we're going to talk about TSC LAM, tuberous sclerosis complex LAM. The TSC is a disorder caused by a genetic mutation of the TSC1 gene on chromosome 9q34 or of the TSC2 gene on chromosome 16q13. This mutation results in abnormal growth or lesions in the brain, kidney, skin, heart, and lungs due to too much of a protein called mTOR. TSC-LAM, or lymphangioleiomyomatosis, is the name for one of the pulmonary manifestations of TSC. Symptoms of LAM can be severe regardless of whether the disease is caused by TSC1 or 2. There's also sporadic LAM, like I told you, that occurs in mostly women who don't have TSC. LAM in that setting is usually more severe. TSC-LAM affects women more than men. It causes cystic destruction of healthy lung tissue, pneumothorax or collapsed lung, and chylous pleural effusions of fluid in the lung. LAM cells are like smooth muscle cells, and these LAM cells exist in microscopic nodules or bundles that originate from outside of the lung. Various primary locations have been hypothesized, but the original source of these LAM cells is not known for sure. Somehow the cells migrate into the lung, likely through the lymphatic system, a part of the vascular system whose primary function is to circulate lymph, a fluid containing infection-fighting white blood cells, throughout the body. Once the LAM cells get into the lung, they start secreting enzymes that break down healthy lung tissue, leaving cysts, or spheres of empty space in both lungs. This compromises the lung's ability to move oxygen from the air breathed in for transport to the body's cells, as well as being able to exhale carbon dioxide efficiently. In addition, the LAM cells impair the lung's ability to act as an effective support structure, like scaffolding, for the lung's healthy tissue to connect to. Patients with LAM are at very high risk of one or more of these cysts rupturing and causing a collapsed lung, which is a pneumothorax. Pneumothorax typically occurs more than once in a lifetime of a person who has LAM. In addition, if the thoracic duct becomes plugged up with LAM cells, it will not be able to return lymph fluid from the lower part of the body to the heart. And that can cause this lymph fluid to collect in the lung, and that's called a pleural effusion. This collection of lymph fluid occurs more often in people with LAM that is not associated with TSC. Thank goodness. LAM can be a progressive disease and has a more rapid progression in women who have not gone through menopause. LAM can cause daily difficulty with breathing and can lead to oxygen dependence and respiratory failure. A better understanding of the underlying disease process, which is too much mTOR, to say it simply, has resulted in targeted therapies and improved outcomes in those who receive them, as well as opportunities to develop biomarkers and new therapies. The incidence that I've read about is 13,000 to 30,000 women worldwide, but it's probably an underestimate. And as I said before, it occurs more often in females than males. Now we're going to talk about screening. Because TSC-LAM can cause such severe disease if allowed to progress, it is important that women... Are you okay? Because TSC-LAM can cause such severe disease if allowed to progress, it is important that women with TSC be screened for its presence early so that treatment can be started to improve or maintain lung function and prevent LAM's progression and thereby possibly prevent pneumothorax and pleural effusions too. Beginning at the age of 18 years old, women with TSC should be asked at every office or clinic visit if they are having any shortness of breath or difficulty breathing with exertion. They should also have screening high resolution or HR CT of the chest to see if there are any cysts in the lungs. If there are no cysts, the HR CT should be repeated every 5 to 10 years to continue screening. Ongoing testing in those who have been diagnosed with LAM. If there are cysts detected on the screening HR CT, a referral to a pulmonologist who specializes in the treatment of LAM should be made. The LAM pulmonologist will determine if those cysts specifically indicate the presence of LAM. After the diagnosis of LAM is made, pulmonary function testing will be ordered to be done typically 3 to 6 months after the diagnosis of LAM is made, and then every year thereafter to see how the disease is progressing. Pulmonary function testing, or PFTs, are performed by a technician in the pulmonary lab. PFTs involve measurements of lung volume, lung capacity, rates of airflow, which is called spirometry, and gas exchange diffusion between oxygen and carbon dioxide. A pulmonologist will often order the PFTs with a methacholine challenge, the test that is used to diagnose asthma. Sometimes LAM can cause asthma symptoms, and unfortunately, some have a delay in being diagnosed with LAM because they are thought to have asthma instead. Treating the asthma symptoms that can occur in LAM can help that person breathe better. So that's why oftentimes that test is done. Oftentimes a 6-minute walk test with a pulse oximeter attached to one's fingertip to measure oxygen levels is done too. If a patient with LAM is unable to perform PFTs, a blood test called a VEGF-D level may be followed instead. VEGF-D stands for vascular endothelial growth factor, type D. LAM cells produce VEGF-D. VEGF-D helps the LAM cells move through the body's lymphatic system to the lungs. A VEGF-D level will be elevated, typically greater than 800 in LAM. A pulmonologist may also follow LAM with a 6-minute walk test if that person has difficulty performing PFTs. Sometimes people with renal angiomyolipoma and even if they don't have LAM can have elevated VEGF-D levels. Sometimes a low-dose CT scan of the lungs will be ordered for follow-up after a diagnosis of LAM is made. Treatment. People who are diagnosed with LAM should be referred to a pulmonary MD who specializes in the treatment of LAM or one who is at least familiar with LAM and willing to work with a LAM specialist. There are 58 LAM clinics in various locations throughout the world. Asthma type symptoms are treated with different types of inhalers that the pulmonologist will order. And remember how the genetic mutation in TSC causes too much of a protein called mTOR? An mTOR inhibitor medication is a disease-targeted therapy for many of the conditions that afflict people with TS, including LAM. An mTOR inhibitor works by replacing some of the function of the TSC gene, whether it's 1 or 2, that is not working properly. There are 2 mTOR inhibitors available on the market. Rapamycin or sirolimus or rapamune is one, and Afinitor, which is everolimus, is the second. Rapamycin has been FDA approved to treat LAM and has been recommended as the first-line treatment for people with LAM who have abnormal or declining lung function. Afinitor could be prescribed as an alternative treatment for LAM, but is not specifically FDA approved for this indication. Research studies showed that rapamycin specifically stabilized the rate of decline in some lung volumes, improved one's ability to move air in and out of their lungs, improved some quality of life measures, and also decreased VEGF-D levels. A patient has to continue taking the mTOR inhibitor indefinitely for it to continue to work. PFT should be monitored 3 to 6 months after the initiation of an mTOR inhibitor to monitor treatment response. A 6-minute walk test may be done regularly also. There are some labs done when somebody's taking an mTOR inhibitor. Baseline labs before starting the mTOR inhibitor include blood counts, liver and kidney function testing, fasting lipid profile, and urinalysis. And then the lab specialist recommends those labs be repeated every month for 3 months and then every 3 months thereafter. VEGF-D levels can be followed annually with the expectation that the level will go down with mTOR inhibitor treatment. Things that people with LAM who are taking an mTOR inhibitor need to know. Those with LAM who use tobacco or any other inhalant, vaping comes to mind with everything in the news right now. that could hurt the lungs need to stop. Smoking cessation is the most important thing anyone can do for their health, regardless if they have LAM. There can be side effects with mTOR inhibitors, but there are effective ways to manage them. Most common side effect is mouth sores, like if you bit the inside of your cheek. That's the kind of mouth sore that people can experience. Those are more likely to occur when starting an mTOR inhibitor or if the dose is increased. We have various remedies and preventative therapies for that. Wrap immune can make one more sensitive to the sun, so it's important to use sunscreen. Possible immunosuppression can occur when one's taking an mTOR inhibitor, so it's important to notify the prescriber of the mTOR inhibitor if an illness or fever occurs. Vaccinations to boost immunity are recommended, including Prevnar, which is a vaccination against certain types of pneumonia, and that is received once in a lifetime. Pneumovax is a vaccination against other kinds of pneumonia, and that should be given every 5 years. The first dose of the Pneumovax can be 2 months after the Prevnar vaccine. Annual flu vaccine shots are recommended. It's important to avoid live vaccines when taking an mTOR inhibitor. Live vaccines include the flu mist nasal spray, flu vaccine, Zostavax, shingles vaccine, and measles, mumps, rubella. It's okay to have the new shingles vaccine, which is called Shingrix. It's important for patients with LAM who take an mTOR inhibitor to recognize the signs and symptoms of pneumonitis, which can also be a side effect. Pneumonitis is a swelling of the tissue lining of the lung. Symptoms include fever, cough, shortness of breath, and difficulty breathing. Pneumonitis is rare, but can make somebody really sick. So people taking mTOR inhibitors need to know about it. Rapamune should be stopped until the symptoms of the pneumonitis resolve, and then can be reintroduced at some point once the pulmonologist determines if this is appropriate. Other possible side effects include, I'm going to back up. I have never seen anybody suffer from pneumonitis, and we see a lot of patients with LAM, so I'm very grateful for that. I know it occurs, but I think we're better about using lower doses of mTOR inhibitors and monitoring for these side effects before they become really problematic. Other possible side effects include elevated cholesterol, acne, elevated blood sugar, and menstrual cycle irregularities. There are medications that can interact with mTOR inhibitors and make their levels higher, like certain blood pressure and seizure medications and certain antibiotics, or can make the mTOR inhibitor level lower, like certain other seizure medications. So the bottom line is it's important for there to be a drug interaction check before a new medication or over-the-counter remedy is taken. About pneumothorax, which is the lung collapse problem. Since pneumothorax can occur in most of the patients who have LAM, it's important for patients with LAM to know the symptoms, which are sudden onset of shortness of breath and chest pain, oftentimes on one side. The pain is worse when taking a deep breath. If this happens, the person should go to the emergency department immediately, where a chest tube may be inserted to help the lung reinflate. Sometimes it reinflates on its own. Pleurisesis is a procedure that could be done. Pleurisesis helps to hold the lung in place once it is reinflated. The goal of pleurisesis is for the treated lung to be less likely to collapse in the future, so should be strongly considered. People with LAM should avoid scuba and skydiving, but otherwise have no activity restrictions. Exercise is encouraged as it makes our lungs stronger and has many other health benefits. Air travel is safe. The incidence of a pneumothorax occurring on a flight is very rare and is more likely to occur if it's going to occur on a flight than coming down from the sky. If it does, the flight attendant should be alerted and the person could use oxygen on the plane if needed until they can, you know, get limited to get emergency care. About hormone therapy. Hormone therapy should be avoided. If hormone therapy is needed, it should be with, and we're talking about women, It should be with progestin or progesterone, not estrogen, as estrogen and pregnancy have been shown to accelerate the disease progression in women. An important note about scans and radiation. MRIs don't expose people to radiation, but CT scans do. HRCT stands for type of CT scan that does not use as much radiation, so it reduces the amount one is exposed to each time an HRCT is done, which would be every 5 to 10 years for lamb screening. A low-dose CT is sometimes done as a follow-up scan for patients who have been diagnosed with LAM. It's important to make sure that the CT used for LAM screening and follow-up is delivering the lowest possible dose of radiation. Another lung condition that can occur in TSC is MMPH, or multifocal micronodular pneumocyte hyperplasia. This will be seen as a pulmonary or lung nodule on a CT scan. This is not LAM. MMPH nodules are benign, non-disease causing, as they don't grow or cause symptoms. They're just like an additional growth that people with TS experience. It's very common. It's a very common finding in TSC, occurring in 50% of those who have TSC. There's no need to repeat imaging to follow these nodules. If there is a concern about them, one can be referred to a LAM pulmonologist who's familiar with TSC for evaluation. The Lamposium is a conference whose goal is to create a place for patients and their family members and friends to share their experiences about LAM and to learn the latest news about LAM research and clinical care recommendations from LAM experts and to meet others with LAM and the experts that treat it. The next Lamposium is next year, April 30th through May 3rd, in Cincinnati, Ohio, at the Summit Hotel. You can find more information about it on the LAM Foundation website. And the TS Alliance might have it on their website, too. I didn't look. And then about research. The MILD trial is actively enrolling patients with LAM. Dr. Gusta wanted me to share this. MILD, M-I-L-E-D, is an acronym for Multicenter Interventional LAM Early Disease. It is studying the use of low-dose sirolimus, which is also called rapamycin or rapamune, in LAM. Criteria for enrollment include adult women with a diagnosis of LAM who they cannot have already been on an mTOR inhibitor, and their lung function has to be normal. If you're interested, you can call Susan McMahon, the RN and study coordinator, to learn more. And I do have her contact information. Would you want me to give that to you now?
Yes, sure.
Okay. So Susan McMahon, her email address is I'm going to spell it for you, is susan.mcmahan, like in Nancy, at uc.edu. And her phone number is 513-558-4376. And there's also information about other trials on the LAM Foundation website. So that is the overview. I hope it was helpful to you. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
Karen, well,
this is Kathy. I do have a question. I met about 17 years ago at, hi there, it was great review. I love that. But I do have a question that I have been asked and wondering myself. I met about 17 years ago at the NIH with Dr. Moss. He had talked about that was kind of really the beginning of maybe testing some ladies that might be in their 40s and showing LAM, but that doesn't really know how long they have had LAM. They were hoping back after a decade or two decades, which is, you know, approximately then now, that they would possibly, no guarantee, but is there an approximate age now with the women, if they're not having any findings, that they can kind of sigh a little bit, or do you have any input at all on that?
Mm-hmm. So the most, apparently the most common age that women are diagnosed with LAM are between the ages of 30 and 35. And when you read articles, they don't really say, they don't differentiate between TSC LAM and sporadic LAM. But, you know, in one of the benefits is when you have TSC, you're going to get screened earlier. You're going to get screened earlier and you're going to get diagnosed sooner. And so your LAM is not going to progress like it can in the sporadic LAM where, you know, these women might be diagnosed with asthma because a lot of their symptoms seem to be like asthma. And hence, you know, more their disease progresses farther before they're diagnosed and get the adequate treatment. So when I asked Dr. Gupta about screening every 5 to 10 years and you know, if somebody... You know, if somebody who's 35 years old doesn't have any cysts, which is what your question is, do they still have to be screened every 5 to 10 years? And he told me yes. He said yes. You don't want to miss the diagnosis, and so that's what he said. But I think that you know, if you are 35 years old and you have normal lungs, and one of the other things that will likely be monitored. Right now it's not a standard recommendation, is the VEGFD level. So, you know, if a woman has healthy lungs without cysts and her VEGFD level is low, it seems as though that should provide lots of reassurance. And, you know, when Dr. Gupta and Dr. McCormick meet with our patients, sometimes we have patients that are diagnosed at the age of 35. In order to be diagnosed, you have to have more than one cyst. I can't remember what the number is now. I think it's 4 or greater. They almost always reassure them that they're, you know, depending on what the situation is, oftentimes they're reassuring our female patients who are diagnosed with LAM for the first time when they're older that they're going to be okay. So and sometimes they don't even prescribe an mTOR inhibitor. So it's just, that's the importance of, you know, seeing a pulmonary doctor who knows what they're doing with managing this disease because they will be able to, you know, reassure better because they're seeing lots and lots and lots of people with this problem and they see trends and things. So I don't know if that answered your question as well as you.
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate it.
I have a mother-in-law who I'm sure had TSC and LAM. She had the skin manifestations and always was diagnosed with asthma all her life. And she took inhalers and got chest x-rays and smoked. And she lived to be 88. Maybe she, can you pick that up with a chest x-ray?
No, I don't think that's an adequate enough test to pick it up because it's not recommended as screening. You know, it's just like with the kidney lesions, that it's better picked up with MRI than renal ultrasound. So, but I know what you're saying is that, you know, she lived her life and she was getting all these chest x-rays and maybe she had this condition that could have been better treated.
Started in her 30s and it just went on and on and she had a lot of hospitalizations for that. And
did she ever have any pneumothorax?
No, but she, at 88, her diagnosis was asthma-related death in a nursing home. But you said that when they're diagnosed older, it doesn't seem as bad.
Well, if the disease begins when they're older, so
like how much older?
Well, if you're diagnosed before menopause, just because you have more circulating estrogen in your system, your disease could, you know, potentially be progressed to a worse stage than if it doesn't begin until you're 50.
Okay, so if somebody has a hysterectomy.
Well, when somebody has a hysterectomy, there's different kinds of hysterectomies. It depends on if you... So, and oftentimes people have, when they have their ovaries removed, then they're prescribed hormones, depending on how old they are when they get the total hysterectomy. So it's the same, we have to be careful about the external, we call them exogenous hormones or hormone pills that oftentimes people are given when they have a total hysterectomy, because then there's that they usually consist of both estrogen and progestin.
Mm-hmm. If someone has Mirena IUD, I think that provides some progesterone, doesn't it?
So a Mirena IUD has progestin, yes, progesterone.
Okay.
And, like I said,
on the estrogen level?
No, because it's progestin, it's not estrogen. So if somebody needs to have something like that, the Mirena is one that's recommended versus I think that there are some that have estrogen, that emit estrogen too, and you wouldn't want that. But the Mirena, if you have to have something like that, the Mirena would be the most appropriate one. And then there's one that's smaller.
Does that do anything with the estrogen level?
No, because it doesn't have estrogen. It doesn't emit estrogen.
Will the estrogen level still be high? I mean, normal, like everybody else without a hysterectomy? You're saying that after menopause, the estrogen is down, and a lot of times it's replaced with estrogen replacement. But if you have a Mirena IUD, does the patient still have estrogen production?
If they have ovaries.
Okay, that was my question.
Yeah. And they're not through menopause, which they wouldn't have an IUD if they were through menopause, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
We think that IUDs can actually, I don't know if there's any research about it, but sometimes we think that IUDs can kind of stabilize hormone fluctuations and actually help treat epilepsy. So who knows, maybe it does kind of dumb down the estrogen, but I don't know that we really know that for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because our daughter was just diagnosed with LAM, and she has a Mirena IUD. She's 36. And she's getting ready to have it replaced. She's had it replaced once every 5 years. And it was given for hypermensis.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they did. Dr. Fons recommended, actually, but Children's put it in Cincinnati, and it's just worked wonders, especially with the bleeding all the time.
Yeah.
So she's getting ready to
really
get that replaced. I was just getting my hopes up that maybe that would help with the LAM.
I think we don't know. We just don't know. So
that'd be interesting to study.
Yeah. So can your daughter do pulmonary function testing?
No. She won't cooperate.
No.
You probably know who this is.
I am kind of, thinking that I do.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. So,
Cool Whip lady. It's the Cool Whip lady. Now you know.
So, so if your daughter couldn't, pulmonary function testing is really hard for anybody to do. And if so, what would happen is that she would be followed by VEGF-D levels and maybe like a 6-minute walk test, that kind of thing. Yeah.
And my timer on how long she can hold a breath under the water in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
The summer.
Yeah, and exercise is a great thing. People that exercise have stronger lungs, and it's a good thing.
Right. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Hey, Karen?
Yes?
Okay.
Yes?
I was at, yes, hi, it's Scott. So I wanted to ask you about MMPH. And because I heard Dr. McCormick talk about it at the World Conference, and he said one of the, I guess, symptoms or manifestations is ground glass nodules in the lungs. And I was just wondering, how is MMPH diagnosed? Because I didn't have, is it something that, is it something that, it was always there. My doctor, had said, men don't get lamb. So, here's some literature that, you might want to think of it. Let's, monitor it and stuff like that. And, I have asthma when, quote unquote, I get like bronchitis or something. But I take like a pill of Singulair and I'm good. So, and I have PFTs when I'm sick, so it's been okay with, just give a little bit of steroid and then after that. But, how would a diagnosis be made? I have one in my thorax, which nobody understood why. I was in the ER with a bit of back pain. They thought it was like from an AML. But, so given that, what would be my next move to get like diagnosed if I need to?
Right. So first of all, you need to see a pulmonologist that specializes in LAM to see if, and the reason why is because you have these questions about MMPH. So has somebody diagnosed you with MMPH?
No. No, they haven't. And that's what I was sort of asking. What is the difference between MMPH and LAM? That was the question.
Okay.
And
the only reason that I would suggest that you see a pulmonologist who specializes in LAM is because you have a history of a pneumothorax. So MMPH is just, how people with TS, you can have lesions anywhere, and some people have more lesions than other people. And so just like the bumps on your nose, the MMPH is just like a nodule that is in the lung tissue, and it doesn't cause any trouble or symptoms typically. It's just like one of those TS bumps, but it just happens to be in the lung, and so it has a different name. So that you don't usually, because it doesn't cause any trouble, you don't screen for it because you don't really have to treat it. And what happens sometimes is that people will get scans of their abdomen and, part of the lower part of your lung will show up in that scan of the abdomen. And, the radiologist might make a notation that they saw a nodule in the left lower lobe of the lung or right lower lobe or something like that. So, but the MMPH shouldn't cause pneumothorax or anything like that. So the difference with the MMPH, the MMPH is a nodule. So it's like a, a nodule, like a solid.
Yeah. No, I understand.
Whereas LAM is a cyst, it's an empty space. So but I understand probably what you're thinking is that maybe at first it might look like a nodule, but I don't think so in my reading. The LAM cells, the bundle of LAM cells that travels to the lungs secrete enzymes that eat away at that healthy lung tissue and create a cyst or an air-filled sphere. So there's like no lung tissue in that spot. There's not a nodule or anything. It's empty. It's totally empty, and that's what LAM is.
Okay, so it's mentioned nodules. But what's the ground glass have to do with that? Because I've seen that in some of the literature, that's ground glass nodules. You know what I'm referring to?
Yes, I do know what you're talking about.
That's what it says.
So,
okay.
So I'm not going to claim to be a pulmonologist expert, but sometimes with our patients that sometimes there's a concern that ground glass is associated with pneumonitis. But sometimes we see it, you know, in our, like a woman that's taking an mTOR inhibitor for renal angiomyolipoma. We'll get her screening, but she doesn't have LAM. She'll get her screening CT of her lungs, and there might be a notation of that, possible ground glass. But she's, like, totally healthy. She doesn't have any shortness of breath, difficulty breathing. There are no cysts in her lungs. Does FT levels okay? And even our pulmonologists aren't really sure because the person doesn't have any symptoms. They're healthy. What to make of that. So, but sometimes it is supposed, you know, I've read and I've heard our pulmonologists say that if somebody is symptomatic, they would worry that that was a symptom of pneumonitis.
What exactly?
I'm just not going to be able to answer the ground glass question very well. I'm sorry.
Okay, no, but no problem. What is pneumonitis?
But I think
I've never heard that.
Scott, you need to see a pulmonary doctor who specializes in LAM because you have that pneumothorax, and you need to make sure that you do not have LAM because it can occur in men. It's usually not as severe in men, probably because you know men don't have estrogen. But that being said, it sounds, you know, it's just something that I think you need to explore and be reassured about.
Yes. No, I plan on it, so thank you for that. But I guess one term I've never...
And don't let anybody cut your nodules out of your lungs, because sometimes doctors think that these bumps are cancer, and you know, they're not. And we don't want anybody to cut those out until we really know what they are. Well...
And I was just going to ask, what's the percentage of men that get LAM these days? Because I knew it was very small, but now I've actually met men that have LAM, and so I'm just curious about that.
Yeah. You know what? I don't know that they really know, because just like the number of women, you know, 13 to 30,000, that's an underestimate, because there's probably more women out there that are just not diagnosed. So I'm trying to see if I have a percentage. Yeah, we have several men in our clinic that have LAM, but they're all asymptomatic. So I'm trying to find the percentage. But any other questions?
Just one thing. What's pneumonitis? That's the first time I've ever heard it once you said it. So I'm just curious what it is.
So pneumonitis is a nonspecific swelling of the tissue that lines the lung. And it can be caused by mTOR inhibitors. So, and it actually can look like pneumonia, those symptoms that I said, shortness of breath and cough and fever. So sometimes it's difficult, even Dr. McCormick has told us this, it's difficult to differentiate between pneumonitis and pneumonia, because it doesn't always have to be generalized, meaning it doesn't always affect the whole lung. It might just affect one lung in a certain area. And so... But the treatment for it, and, you know, anybody who's diagnosed with pneumonia, and if they took an mTOR inhibitor, they would need to let the person who prescribes the mTOR inhibitor know, and the treatment for it is for pneumonitis is to stop the mTOR inhibitor. And if somebody had pneumonia, you would also stop the mTOR inhibitor because of the possibility of the mTOR inhibitor causing immunosuppression and you know, impairment of a person's ability to completely heal. So, yeah, it's just a non-generalized swelling of the lung tissue that causes these symptoms that can mimic pneumonia.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that explanation.
You're welcome.
Anyone else have some questions for Karen?
I have one. Do people with LAM have a higher risk of pulmonary embolism?
Not that I've read.
Okay. Well, that's not something you see very often.
No. We had one patient had a pulmonary embolism, but she doesn't have LAM. I mean, it was totally unrelated. So pulmonary embolism is either, it can either be air or it actually goes through the vasculature,
mm-hmm.
meaning it goes through a blood vessel. It's either a clot or air, and it travels through a blood vessel and reduces the blood flow to the certain, you know, the affected area of the lung beyond the obstruction. So it's different.
Right.
Yeah. And no, not that I've read. I haven't read it. I'm sorry, what?
No, go ahead. I'll let you finish.
I just... Oh. I mean, I think I am.
So, sorry, this is Seth, and I'm one of the adult regional coordinators. And my question was actually going to be kind of going back to the questions that Scott was talking about with men. What do you see? Are there kind of different clinical manifestations of LAM in men versus women? Or, you know, I know obviously estrogen plays a role for women, but, you know, are you seeing it kind of different? I know, you know, the lung collapses and things like that in LAM, you know, are probably consistent across male and female, but, you know, the way it presents, things like that, or, you know, are you seeing any major differences there? Or you might have actually said that and I missed it, but.
Mm-hmm. So there's just, so what I can tell you is what we've seen in our clinic, and it's just it just happens to be that somebody's getting a CT scan for some other reason, and then we just happen to see these cysts in men. So, you know, if I think we would probably be able to answer your question better if men were screened. But men aren't screened. So, you know, and because there's such a low incidence in men, and typically men that have it just aren't symptomatic like women are. So as far as you're asking about presentation, so if a man had LAM, you know, if they had LAM, they would have those air-filled pockets in their lungs, and they would still be at risk for having a pneumothorax. And pneumothorax, or, you know, people have the same symptoms. Maybe Scott could let us know how his, you know, with the symptoms that he had when he had a pneumothorax. But just based on I used to be a nurse in the ICU, people have the same symptoms when they have a collapsed lung. You have, you know, terrible shortness of breath and pain on the affected side. And so I don't know that the symptoms in a man would present any different than in a woman if they were going to have symptoms.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you.
And, you know, oftentimes, as I said, people with LAM can have asthma symptoms. So, you know, if an adult man who has PS develops asthma symptoms, it would probably be worthwhile to get a good picture of the lungs to see what's going on in there.
Okay. Is anyone
that's just mine. That's just Karen Agricola talking. I didn't read any of that about, you know, because most of the literature is about women. So, yeah, there should be a study done about men.
Yeah. I just curious.
And there might have been. I didn't see that when I was preparing for this.
Okay. And then, you know, I was just curious, too, and I don't know if you'd know this, whether there was any good surveillance data. You know, I'm sure there is for women, and I'm guessing that the Lamb Foundation would probably have that. I just don't know if there's any good surveillance data for men as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, so surveillance means screening, and the recommendations are for women to be screened beginning at age 18.
Okay.
Yeah. I wish I would have known about your interest with, and I actually can, I'll look up some more information. I'll look and see if I can find some information. I'll talk to Dr. Gustafson and Dr. McCormick, and I can get back with you. I can share that with Dina, and then she could post it somewhere for you all to have access to. Would that be something you would want?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, that would actually be great.
Okay. I will do that. I'm going on vacation for a week, though, so it won't be till I come back.
That's not tonight.
Yeah, I'll come back on October 7th. So. What?
I said
yeah, I'm going on vacation.
A week?
Well, that's just what I've chosen to have. You think I need more than a week?
If I did your job, I'd take a month off. I'm retired.
So here's the deal. You have to not only send, like, links and stuff, you know, about this, you know, but you have to send pictures, too, from vacation to put with it. So, you know,
oh.
It can make it feel better when they look at it.
Okay. Deal.
And if you, just to follow up on what happened with that pneumothorax, it was the craziest. And 2 days before, I had a blood clot in my leg. And then the next day, I was feeling just some pain in my back. And the pain got worse the next day and so bad by that evening that the pain in the back, but then I had shortness of breath. And I said, call an ambulance because I didn't know what was going on. And I went to it was basically my back and going up my, you know, like just severe pain like I've never really felt before. And they were like, you know, they didn't see anything, but once there, when I got to her, it was, you know, my thorax, he said, you know what, that clot could have gone to your lungs, let's do a PE scan. And that came up negative. So they really don't know what happened to me.
How old are you?
So, but you had a pneumothorax, so it wasn't diagnosed as a pulmonary embolism.
No. And it was partially. It was like if I read the thing right, it was partially collapsed. If that means anything.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Yeah. So it can be a partial collapse, and oftentimes it just. Did you have to have a chest tube?
No.
Yeah. Oftentimes you don't need one. So. So did you have a CT of your lungs then?
Yes. Yeah.
So were there any cysts in your lungs?
They didn't say. Well, no. Did I come here? What is it like when it's the CT that you can't see gallstones? if there's something, because I knew, you know, oh, you had a CT, now get an ultrasound, and that's where, I mean, they saw, you know, a cyst in my kidney, but that was growing a bit, whether that was the pain that it caused at that point, who knows. But, you know, I did a follow-up with that, and, you know, thank God nothing's going on with that. But,
yeah. So did you have to take blood thinners after this happened?
So on that, I happen to have a tumor in my eye, which I'm having hemorrhaging with.
Oh.
And doctor does not want me on blood thinners. So that was my third clot. And you know, I actually saw a clot set specialist, and they said, if you get another clot, you got to really talk about what you're going to do, and it's going to be a wild conversation because they don't know. Nobody knows.
So there's genetic conditions.
You know. What?
How old are you?
I'm going to be 53 next week.
Well, happy birthday.
I'm
going to
be 53 next week. Thank you.
Oh, happy birthday.
So, Scott, I have a couple other questions for you. So there are genetic conditions that, so TS doesn't do this, but there are other genetic conditions that are just, I don't know if it's really a condition, but there's different gene mutations that can cause somebody to excessively clot.
Yes, I know. I have factor V laden. That's what you were going
to. Okay. So what about getting, I'm trying to think of what they're called. It's like a, they put it in your inferior vena cava. It's like a,
yeah, it's a filter,
like an umbrella
filter,
kind
of. Filter.
Do you have one of those?
No. But I think that would be the next step of this thing instead of a blood thinner. So.
Yeah.
Not sure. But I'm going to definitely follow up with everyone. And, yeah, we're very close to 9 o'clock, so we need to start wrapping up. If there's any last-minute questions. So, Karen, you're going on vacation, but is the way to get in touch with you is to go through Dina if we have follow-up questions?
Yes, that would be the way to reach me.
Okay. So,
and then I'll get you the information about Lan and Nick.
That'd be great. That'd be great. So, you know what? I mean, probably another question will take us over. So I think this is a good stopping point. And I think thank you so much for the information. I know I got a lot. Sorry for monopolizing. But, I think everybody got some good stuff out of this, so thank you very much for being our guest tonight.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Have a great vacation, Karen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.